I realized halfway through Ludmila Chornova's admirable lecture yesterday that there's a slight danger that my talk may be regarded as off-beam. That is, I'm not proposing to talk about issues relating to the public interpretation of history, how, for example, works of art might be interpreted by professional historians, the sorts of issues that I was interested in when I was director of the National Portrait Gallery and Ludmila was one of my trustees. Instead, I'm going to examine an issue which I have become profoundly interested in since I moved next door to the National Gallery. And that is, to what extent is the audience for a public institution an academic audience? And to what extent is it, or should it be, a more public one? At the National Portrait Gallery, this relationship between the profession and the public always felt relatively straightforward, because broadly, there was an understanding that one could and should try to serve both audiences simultaneously. In other words, the public program at the National Portrait Gallery was the outcome of scholarly and academic research, either undertaken by the staff of the National Portrait Gallery or by importing scholars from outside. But at the National Gallery, the relationship seems to me to have been historically more complicated. And it is the nature of the relationship of the National Gallery to first its academic audience, and secondly, its broader public, that I want to explore this morning. I'm proposing to do this historically by looking back at the history of the National Gallery and examining the changing nature of its intellectual and academic responsibilities on the one hand, and the changing public on the other. Let me start with the origins of the National Gallery in the early 1820s. I cannot honestly say that its origins were inspired by a desire to understand and interpret the history of painting. In particular, the selection of works was highly partial, essentially based on the ideas of a small group of connoisseurs who believed that the display of great works of art could improve public taste, rather than being inspired, so far as I can deduce, by any deeper sense of historical or art historical, or indeed cultural scholarship. The idea was, above all, that the study of the art of the past would help to inform and influence the practice of art in the present. In its origins, the National Gallery was formed out of two collections belonging to well-regarded early 19th century connoisseurs. One belonged to John Julius Angerstein, who's on the screen, if we can dim the lights, who was a high-powered city financier of German extraction and one of the founders of Lloyd's Insurance Exchange, who had begun collecting British paintings in the 1790s in order to furnish his house, Woodlands, out at Blackheath, and who in 1798 bought Sebastiano del Piombo's Raising of Lazarus at the great sale of the Orleans collection, which so influenced the collecting of old master paintings in Great Britain. The man behind the screen, if you can put the lights out at the front, which make it very bright. There is a man behind the screen, I'm told. He maybe has his earphones on. The other collection, which formed the basis of the National Gallery, belonged to a Leicestershire landowner called George Beaumont, who had been taught drawing at Eton by Alexander Cousins and began buying British pictures in his 20s when he bought works by his friend, the Welsh artist Thomas Jones. In the early 1780s, Beaumont and his wife went on the grand tour, and in Rome he developed his interests in drawing and in the antique, not least through his friendship with Jones. He had fairly conventional tastes of his period, and when he returned to England, he began to collect old master paintings, buying Claude's Landscape with Hagar and the Angel at a sale in April 1785, and Poussin's Landscape with a Man Washing His Feet at a Fountain in 1787. In 1790, he was elected a Member of Parliament for Beer Alston, and in 1792, he added what he described as a picture room to his townhouse in Grosvenor Square. It was Beaumont who persuaded Parliament that it ought to buy Angostine's collection in 1822 with the promise that, if they did so, he would himself present his own collection. His intentions were not, I think, art historical, or at the very least, his views of history were extremely partial. Neither collection was organized on remotely historical principles. Neither collector was interested in the concept of a representative collection. Instead, they collected in the mainstream of then contemporary taste. Claude, Poussin, Guido Reni amongst old masters, Reynolds, Gainsborough, and Constable amongst modern British artists. Their interests in making their collections available to a broader public were first and above all in order to provide inspiration to modern artists. In other words, to create a strong sense of dialogue between the art of the past and the art of the present. And secondly, to educate public taste and to provide the opportunity to a broader public to see and enjoy great works of art. I've not detected anywhere in the early rhetoric surrounding the establishment of the National Gallery any sense that the pictures should be arranged chronologically in order that visitors should understand the different schools of painting, nor that acquisitions should be made in the then unfashionable areas of painting, including early Italian art, even in spite of the fact that there were collectors like William Roscoe in Liverpool who were beginning to collect in this field. It's a view of the early interior in Pall Mall. The first curator of the collection was not someone who could be described as in any sense an art historian, but instead was a picture dealer and restorer called William Seguier, whose father had been a picture dealer in Covent Garden and whose brother John sold books and topographical prints in Soho. In 1813, when the Duke of Wellington acquired a huge collection of paintings as booty after the Battle of Vittoria, he sent Seguier out to Spain to supervise their restoration. And it was Seguier who compiled the manuscript catalogue of the principal pictures when they were hung in Apsley House in 1816. In 1820, Seguier was appointed as the surveyor, cleaner, and repairer of the King's pictures. His duties were to survey the collections of pictures in the various royal palaces, to give advice when required, and to repair and clean pictures when this was agreed to be necessary. He was essentially a royal factotum, responsible for overseeing the royal collection, making sure that the pictures were in good order, and providing attributions, but not for otherwise interpreting and studying them. There's no evidence that he had any particularly scholarly interests in the history of art, although he was interested in attributions. Question then is, at what point did the National Gallery change its character from being essentially a public version of a private collection to being an institution which made efforts to explore and demonstrate the history of art more systematically? The answer is that it's essentially due to one man, Charles Locke Eastlake, although, as is always the case, he is representative of broader changes in the surrounding culture, and the fact that, by the mid-19th century, there had been a great deal of professionalisation in the study of history and the beginnings of scholarly writing about art, not least by Eastlake's wife, Elizabeth Rigby, who in 1836 was responsible for the translation and publication of J.P. Passavant's Essay on English Art Collections under the title Tour of a German Artist in England. Eastlake was born in 1793, educated at Plymouth Grammar School and subsequently at Charterhouse, and was trained as a painter under Benjamin Robert Hayden and the Royal Academy Schools. In 1815, he travelled to France and was inspired by the many paintings which had been looted from foreign collections and subsequently displayed in the Musée Napoléon. This gave him an unusual interest in the historical development of art and in the ways whereby an encyclopedic collection of paintings could enhance their study. He then travelled to Rome, where he set himself up in a studio in 12 Piazza Mignanelli, where he stayed for the following 14 years. As a result of this experience, he had an infinitely broader and deeper knowledge of the history of art than the great majority of his British contemporaries. He knew intimately many private collections and was also friendly with many contemporary German artists, including Passavant, who were themselves interested in the history of art, and were to form the group known as the Nazarenes. In 1828, after returning to England, Eastlake travelled for nearly 3 months in Flanders, the Netherlands, Germany and Northern Italy, studying works of art in the newly established museums and galleries on the continent, and buying books for his art historical library. During this time, he developed an interest in early Netherlandish as well as in early Italian painting, and in Berlin he made friends with Gustav Wagen, one of the founders of the discipline of art history, who had already established his reputation as a scholar in the history of art with the publication in 1822 of a monograph on Hubert and Jan van Eyck based on documentary research. So when Eastlake was appointed keeper of the National Gallery in 1843, he was a completely different kind of person from Séguier. He was a well-established scholar of art who had translated Goethe's Theory of Colours in 1840, and in 1842 had translated F.T. Kugler's widely read book on Italian schools of painting. The move from Séguier to Eastlake was essentially the move from the Regency to the Victorian age, from smart amateurism to professional dedication, from the world of the picture dealer to that of the scholar. Eastlake's first experience in the National Gallery was not at all happy. He had no money for acquisitions, was berated by Ruskin for buying a Guido Reni, and at the same time attacked for buying a so-called bad Holbein, as well as for the cleaning of pictures in 1844. He resigned in 1847 in order to devote himself to the publication of his major work on materials for a history of oil painting, published in 1847, and his contributions to the literature of the fine arts in 1848. However, in 1855, after a period of chaos in the gallery and the meeting of a select committee to investigate its affairs, he was reappointed as a proper, fully-fledged director, with Ralph Wernham as his keeper and a travelling agent, Otto Mundler, to act as a scout for acquisitions abroad. There's no doubt whatsoever that the appointment of Eastlake as director led to a much more professional approach, not only to the collection of works of art, but also to their study. The terms of his appointment included the requirement that he should seek to acquire good specimens of the Italian school, including those of earlier masters. Another was as follows. One of the most important duties of the director, and one which will require great care and attention, will be to construct a correct history of every picture in the collection, including its repairs, and describing accurately its present condition, which history will be continued from time to time by new entries as occasion may require. Eastlake was responsible for great acquisitions like Uccello's Battle of San Romano, Veronese's Family of Darius before Alexander, both of which were acquired in 1857, and Bronzino's Venus, Cupid and Time, acquired in 1860. But he was also responsible for a much more systematic approach to the study and display of the collection, including the preparation of the first entries for a systematic catalogue. His notes on pictures in foreign collections remain an important source for art historical study. Art history, or at least a 19th century version of it, had arrived at the National Gallery. Ralph Wernham, Eastlake's keeper, was, like Eastlake, quite a scholarly figure, having travelled widely in Europe between 1834 and 1840 and been responsible for the first catalogue of the National Gallery's collection, published in 1847. He lived in the gallery, making it possible for his directors to travel abroad, and in 1867 he published a major monograph on Holbein, some account of the life and works of Hans Holbein, painter of Augsburg, with numerous illustrations. Eastlake's successor as director was another painter, William Boxall, a slightly lugubrious bachelor who enriched the gallery's collection of Dutch 17th century paintings by the acquisition of works such as Peter de Hoogh's Woman and Her Maid in a Courtyard in 1869, and by negotiating the acquisition of Robert Peel's collection of paintings in 1871. Wernham's successor as keeper was, oddly enough, Eastlake's nephew, Charles Locke Eastlake, who, like his uncle, was a writer, but mainly in the field of architecture and interior decoration. He's the author of Hints on Household Taste in Furniture, Upholstery and Other Details, published in 1868, and his remarkable History of the Gothic Revival in England, published in 1872. Not surprisingly, the younger Eastlake was deeply interested in the hanging of pictures, and indeed published articles on the subject, in which he suggested that pictures should be hung not as a miscellaneous chronological assortment, but according to scholastic subdivision. He was extremely annoyed and disappointed not to be appointed as director following the retirement of Frederick Burton in 1894. If one looks back at the first six directors of the National Gallery, all six were first trained and practiced as artists and only then turned themselves into what one might describe as generalist arts administrators. Only one, Charles Holmes, was an Oxbridge graduate. None were trained in any great depth in the humanities. The majority of them probably thought of themselves as artists first and arts administrators second. I don't think any of them would have thought of themselves as art historians, even if the term had existed. Not even, I suspect, Charles Eastlake, who combined being director of the National Gallery with being president of the Royal Academy. Frederick Burton was an Irish landscape painter who, from 1851 to 1856, had been employed by Maximilian II of Bavaria as curator of the Royal Collection in Munich. He was succeeded in 1894 by Edward Poynter, who was trained at the Royal Academy schools and then worked as a decorative artist before being appointed as the first Slade Professor of Fine Art at University College London. Like Eastlake, he combined being director of the National Gallery with being president of the Royal Academy. He was succeeded in 1904 by Charles Holroyd, a printmaker of amiable but nervous disposition, who resigned because of ill health in 1916 and seems to have been fairly ineffectual, much bullied by his autocratic trustees. Next came Charles Holmes, a much more robust person, been a scholar at Eton and a student at Brasenose College, Oxford, before becoming a publisher's assistant, working for Charles Ricketts and Charles Shannon at the Vale Press, and then turning his hand to art criticism, writing books on Hokusai, the Japanese printmaker and constable, before becoming co-editor of the newly established Burlington Magazine in 1903. I suppose Holmes might have thought of himself to an extent an art historian, although he too doubled as a landscape painter and was really a generalist, with a much more developed interest in the interpretation of works of art to a broad public rather than in their detailed study. At the level of gallery staff, the keeper for most of Holmes's period of office was Charles Collins Baker, a serious scholar of British art, but one who was described in his obituary in the Burlington Magazine as representative of the last great age of the self-taught scholar in England, before it was permissible to call oneself an art historian. And Lely and the Stuart Portrait Painters, published in 1912, achieved with no greater mechanical aid than a bicycle, is the last great scholarly monument of that generation. The other keeper in the 1920s, who was to become assistant director and was widely expected to become director in due course, was W.G. Constable, who had begun his life as a lawyer before becoming a tour guide at the Wallace Collection, and who at the National Gallery devoted himself to getting to know all the major collectors before being appointed the first director of the Courtauld Institute when it opened in 1931. All of this suggests that the role of the National Gallery during its first 100 years was at least as much to provide a source of inspiration to artists and to the broader public as it was to be a place of scholarly study of the history and attribution of works of art. I think a change in its sense of itself came about in the early 1930s, perhaps marked by the appointment in 1929 of Ellis Waterhouse as an assistant keeper. It was already evident that Waterhouse was going to be a brilliant scholar. Precocious schoolboy with a first-class degree in mods at Oxford, he came to the National Gallery by way of Princeton, where he had been a Commonwealth Fund fellow and had worked under the art historian Frank Mather on El Greco. Having been at Princeton, he was knowledgeable about current German and American art historical scholarship. He was therefore shocked by the ignorance and amateurishness of his colleagues at the National Gallery, and indeed resigned in 1933 in order to move to Rome, where he wrote his pioneering monograph on Baroque painting in Rome. In 1930, Martin Davis joined the staff as an attaché, and like Waterhouse, he helped to pioneer much more scholarly and systematic approach to the study of the works of art under his care, announcing in the Burlington Magazine in 1937 a new approach to cataloguing. A proposed re-edition of the National Gallery catalogues was expected to embody a scholarship more ample and more up-to-date, which forced the staff to consider many difficult problems. This was an understatement. Davis essentially devoted his life to the most scrupulous examination of works of art, most notably in the Slate Quarry in North Wales, where the collection was hidden during the Second World War, and where Davis was able to work away throughout the Second World War, undistracted by other duties. The third of the scholarly curators who joined the staff during the 1930s was Philip Pouncey, who arrived in 1934 and developed the extraordinary skills of connoisseurship, which he devoted after the Second World War to the specialist study of Italian drawings in the British Museum. I suppose the point at which the history of the National Gallery joins most visibly to the history of art is through the appointment on January 1, 1934, of the young Kenneth Clarke to succeed Sir Augustus Daniel, an archaeologist and former director of the British School at Rome. Clarke was, at least in his early years, an art historian par excellence. A Wykamist, he studied history at Oxford, then went to work for Bernard Berenson at Itati, before returning to London in 1929, in order to catalogue the collection of Leonardo drawings at Windsor Castle. In 1930, he was one of the organisers of the Great Exhibition of Italian Art at Burlington House, made possible by the fascist government. And in 1931, he was appointed keeper at the Ashmolean. Of course, it's become usual for art historians to be contemptuous of Kenneth Clarke's qualifications as an art historian, as indeed were his colleagues at the National Gallery, as if he was too rich, too successful, and too social for him to be properly regarded as a scholar. But I defy any art historian to be altogether dismissive of his catalogue of Leonardo drawings, published in 1935, and his monograph on Leonardo, published in 1939, just before the outbreak of the Second World War. We'll be clear from this account that the 1930s was the era not only of the professionalisation of the National Gallery, but also of the professionalisation of the discipline of art history in Britain more generally. With the move of the Warburg Institute from Hamburg to London in the early 1930s came émigré scholars. Fritz Saxel, who had worked with A.B. Warburg as his research assistant since 1913, was responsible for moving Warburg's library to London in 1933, Henry Frankfurt, the great Egyptologist, Gertrude Bing, and the great student of the psychology of images, Ernst Gombrich. These four were to succeed one another as directors of the Warburg Institute, and in combination transformed the whole idea of art history and its study from being an occasionally slightly amateurish study of issues of attribution and biography to being a proper branch of the humanities, with deep roots in the history of the classical tradition and a commitment to the study of the subject matter of works of art more than their style. Meanwhile, the Courtauld Institute was likewise enriched by the appointment of a great émigré scholar to its staff, Johannes Wilder, a former employee of the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna, as well as of Anthony Blunt, a highly intellectual Cambridge mathematician who had based his studies of Poussin on the library of the Warburg Institute in the days when it was still based in South Kensington. After the war, it was obviously impossible for the National Gallery to ignore the existence of the professional discipline of art history, although there may still have lingered some of the residual prejudice against it as being a foreign import, which led Henry Hake to forbid the appointment of anyone trained at the Courtauld Institute to the staff of the National Portrait Gallery. The post-war director of the National Gallery was Philip Hendy, a slightly difficult and rebarbative character who had been a curator at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in the early 1930s, was a very active director of Leeds City Art Gallery from 1934 to 1946. On Hendy's staff, he had at least two well-regarded art historians, besides Martin Davis, who succeeded him as director in 1968. Cecil Gould, the author of monographs on Correggio and Parmigianino, as well as more general books on Bernini and the Musée Napoléon, and a catalogue of the 16th century collection, and Michael Levy, a brilliant writer and scholar who was author of books on the early and high Renaissance. The early Renaissance won the Hawthornden Prize, scholarly monographs on Tiepolo and 18th century Venice, as well as biographies of Mozart and Walter Pater. Levy would, I suspect, have regarded himself at least as much as a professional art historian as a straightforward museum professional. This was in line with the post-war trend for those working in national museums to regard their primary responsibility as being to the development of their professional subject area as scholars, alongside their more general responsibilities for acquisition, interpretation, and display. I suppose this was the era which formed my professional consciousness, both as an art historian and, as you gathered, as someone who started working at the V&A in 1982. I remember there's a character in C.P. Snow's The Masters, who's told that if he fails to get a college fellowship at Cambridge, he can always go and work in the British Museum. In other words, museums were there for people who didn't necessarily want to teach, but who wanted to write and research and publish within their professional subject area, and that the distinction between those who worked in universities and those who worked in museums was that the latter tended to be rather more empirical, rather more object-based, and necessarily rather more involved with the world of Bond Street and private collectors, but that they were otherwise very much part of the same intellectual and scholarly community. What then has happened to fracture this amity? It seems to me obvious that the two professional subject areas of museums and art history began to diverge quite sharply in the early 1980s. When I worked at the V&A in the 1980s, it was subject to a whole range of changes which were broadly intended to shift the balance of professional activity away from the academic study of the collections towards their care and interpretation for a broad public. How the public interacted with the collections, what they learnt from them, how these collections were displayed, how easily they were accessible. These all became the normal professional concerns of museums, much more than the next article in the Burlington magazine. At the same time, the expansion of art history in the new universities, the rise of the new art history, the tyranny of the research assessment exercise, and the absence of any necessary encounter with the works of art themselves, all of these tended to create amongst university art historians a much more narrow set of professional preoccupations, such that they tended to speak more to their professional colleagues and not to pay so much attention as they traditionally might have done to a broader audience. Of course, this is not the whole story, because there can be no doubt that with Neil McGregor as director, the National Gallery remained and in many ways reinforced its role as a powerhouse of traditional art history. Neil himself was very active in fostering a strong sense of the National Gallery's scholarly and academic responsibilities, ensuring, for example, that the new Sainsbury Wing Lecture Theatre was used for major scholarly conferences and that the public was aware of the tremendous work which had been done over many years in the gallery's conservation and scientific departments. In Nick Penny, he recruited a scholar of the highest calibre, in the first instance as Claw curator of Renaissance paintings and subsequently as keeper. It was McGregor who re-established the National Gallery catalogues as publications of the highest scholarly standards, including the volume on 15th century Netherlandish paintings by Lorne Campbell, who arrived as senior research curator from the Courtauld Institute. Meanwhile, the National Gallery has continued to publish its technical bulletin, which is one of the leading scholarly publications in its field, and has had a long run of scholarly exhibitions in the Sainsbury Wing, including the series on art in the making, the catalogues of which remain in print as standard scholarly texts, and which exemplify a particular style of detailed, interdisciplinary scholarly investigation, with a particular emphasis on technical examination. Throughout the last decade, there have been repeated examples of the National Gallery working closely with university art historians, including, most recently, contributions made by Charles Hope, Jennifer Fletcher to our Titian exhibition, David Davis to El Greco, and Tom Henry to Raphael. What will be clear, I hope, from this account is that the National Gallery perceives its relationship as being with professional art history rather than with professional history, unlike the National Portrait Gallery, which has always thought of itself as an institution of public history and has always had professional historians on its board of trustees. Indeed, now has David Cannadine as its chairman. As I walked back yesterday from the conference, I was trying to think exactly why this has been. And the answer is, I hope, obvious from the institution's history. There's always been a premium set on the experience of art by a broad public, on aesthetics, more than on contextual or cultural interpretation. Insofar as the National Gallery is related to the scholarly community, its community has tended to be with professional art historians whose concerns have been with issues of identification and attribution, with connoisseurship, more than with exegesis and interpretation. Now, you will no doubt ask, and I'm absolutely confident that Ludmilla will ask, why should this continue to be the case? And surely it ought to change. And surely we ought not to neglect the needs and demands and expectations of professional historians, who are, after all, just as much a part of our public as professional art historians. The answer is that an institution is very much conditioned by its history, by its genetics and antecedents, and that the history of the National Gallery, as I hope I have demonstrated, has tended to be much more about art and much less about history. Thank you.
Well, I'm delighted to say that we do have a few minutes for questions, and I'm not going to ask that question, so please.
Yes.
I missed the first part of your speech, so please forgive me if you've already mentioned this. I just wondered, have there been peaks and troughs in terms of groups coming into the National Gallery? You mentioned the 1930s as a sort of key area. Was that also a key moment in admissions to the gallery? Did it start to appeal to a broader public?
In terms of admissions, if you look at the numbers of people in relationship to the size of the London population, which somebody called Jonathan Comlin, who's done a PhD thesis, which will be published, I hope, next year, is concerned, it's surprisingly consistent. And in fact, the mood in the 1930s, I mean, it was implied in what I said, I didn't want to be too libelous. Martin Davis obviously much preferred it when the pictures were in the quarry. Because it gave him absolute freedom to do what he regarded as his primary responsibility, which was to study them. And in a sense, the extent to which they were accessible to the public, I think, was then a lesser concern. So what you get is, in a sense, two graphs. One is the extent to which I think the staff of the institution are concentrating on their academic and scholarly responsibilities, and a second, which is not necessarily allied to it, which is a kind of concentration on public enjoyment and appreciation of the collection. I mean, my general sense is that the emphasis on kind of the public was to a considerable but not complete extent due to Kenneth Clark, and also to the experience of the Second World War, where you have to remember all the other collections were in storage, and the only place which remained open was the National Gallery. And the fact that one picture was on display each month during the Second World War, I still think, gives a slightly different relationship of the institution to its public, because people, I mean, of course it's of a particular age and generation, but that fostered a very strong sense of public ownership and of the centrality of the National Gallery within the broader framework of cultural institutions in London. Yes?
You've talked about, in fact, sort of tension really between, in fact, the academic study and the general public. And I wanted to ask you about what sort of position are you personally going to take in terms of, in fact, these two sorts of issues. I particularly sort of was reminded of something that, in fact, I read by you, and I can't remember where, I'm sorry, which was about wonder. And about awe and things like that. And I'm not sure that we've really talked about that sort of thing in this conference so far. So it's been much more about interpretation, knowledge, etc. But there is that sort of element of treasure.
Yes, I mean, I did indeed write about the issue of aura and wonder, which I have been interested in. I mean, I suppose, as is clear from the way I've spoken, at the National Gallery, I inherit a particular attitude and tradition of art history, which I think it's important to protect and develop. When I first wrote this, it was before the HRC made its decision on analog status. And some people may know, and in fact for the National Gallery it's been quite a painful experience, that most of the other national museums, i.e. Victoria and Albert Museum, British Museum, Tate Gallery, National Portrait Gallery, National Maritime Museum, were all awarded analog status, i.e. were regarded as research centres equivalent to university departments, whereas the National Gallery was not. Now, for the National Gallery, which, as will be evident from what I was saying, has always regarded itself as a centre for a particular style of art historical scholarship, I will not disguise the fact that that's been a quite painful experience. And what I'm trying to do at the moment is think through to what extent does it need to adapt, change and adapt in the way it operates. I mean, that part of the answer is really about its scholarly experience. But, you know, there are big tensions because both a lot of government policy and a lot of the institution's sense of itself is to do with the broad public, and that what's important is how people experience the collection and how people look at the paintings, and not how people study and interpret them. So that kind of tension which you have at the heart of the institution and which you have worked out through its history is, I think, one which is, in ways I feel, much more problematic than, as I said at the beginning, at Portrait Gallery, where these issues didn't feel as difficult to negotiate.
Can I suggest we might take one quick question? Is that what when you organise or host exhibitions in collaboration with galleries from abroad, do you sense there is international cultures when you've got an exhibition coming from Berlin or from Paris or from Chicago?
Not really. I mean, we open next Monday an exhibition called Americans in Paris, which is the result of collaboration between us, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It opens with us, then it goes to Boston, then it goes to New York. And it's, interestingly, a collaboration between our head of education in the National Gallery and the relevant curator in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston and the relevant curator in the Metropolitan. I think, in a way, I mean, one of the tensions, I'm not going to go into it now, is between East Coast American museums, or indeed West Coast, but we tend to work with the East Coast ones, which have this kind of, you know, they're not answerable, they're not funded by government in the same way. So that we have pretty straightforward, I think, relations with museums and galleries. I mean, our community has tended to be the community of international museums, rather than, I think, at the Portrait Gallery, the community of scholarship within this country.